Hi guys, welcome to New Books in African American Studies. I'm Sean Hamilton, your host. Today we're talking to Yuval Taylor, co-author of Darkest America, Black Minstrelsy from Slavery to Hip Hop. Yuval, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be there, Sean.
Great. Looking forward to talking to you. I guess first, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write the book.
Well, I've been writing about popular music after my I co-wrote a book called Faking It, The Quest for Authenticity in Popular Music a few years back. And after that, I was doing a blog about, you know, various things in music. And one of the things I posted on the blog was Ethel Waters performing Underneath the Harlem Moon, which was a pretty racist song written in 1930. Which she completely transformed. She performed it in a movie called Rufus Jones for President, also with Sammy Davis Jr., in 1931 or 1932. And she rewrote all the lyrics and made this racist song about how Harlem is just like a plantation into a song of triumph, and just turned everything on its head. And so that got me interested in seeing how African-Americans deal with racist material in general. Other performers were doing that same song without changing the lyrics or changing the lyrics only a little bit. They were taking all these different approaches to it. And so that got me, you know, looking back on African-Americans performing racist material. I knew that there were plenty of African-Americans who performed in minstrel shows. And I was wondering, well, how did they deal with the racist material in minstrel shows? Did they transform it? Did they signify? And I found out that many of them were just playing this racist material totally straight up, without making any changes, doing exactly what the white minstrels were doing. So it inspired me to dig further, and I contacted Jake, because I know he's a real expert on African American comedy, and asked him if he wanted to write this book with me, and he said, yeah, let's do it.
Got you. So just for what exactly is a minstrel show? How do you define it?
Well, a minstrel show is a comic performance performed in blackface by a group of at least four people, but it can be as large as 100. And it replays conventional stereotypes of African Americans in some way or another. And it's almost always for a mixed audience, both blacks and whites.
Okay, got you. And now there's certain stock characters in a minstrel show, right? What are some of those?
Yeah, so I mean Sambo, Zip Coon, you can talk about these characters in various ways, but in general, you're talking about happy, contented blacks on a plantation setting. You're talking about people who are lazy, who do buffoonish comedy, exaggerated features, like to eat, like to like fried chicken, like watermelon. Playing dice, it's just, you know, the same kind of stereotypes that whites have purveyed for centuries about African Americans. That's what you're going to see in the minstrel show.
Right. And now, in the early minstrel shows, they were all white, right? Did they ever tackle subjects that didn't really involve race or racism?
Absolutely. Yeah, the white performers tackled all sorts of subjects. The minstrel show was a space where they could parody anything they wanted. So they parodied opera. Mm-hmm. You know, they parodied Shakespeare. They parodied high society. They parodied all sorts of things. So it wasn't always focused on the plantation and always focused on African-American characters, even though for the most part, they still wore blackface while doing those parodies and talked in this fake dialect. Their subject matter is really varied.
Okay. Now, just out of curiosity, why did they feel the need to wear blackface if they were looking at sort of other subjects like opera or something like that?
Blackface became the convention, one of the defining conventions of the show, because the early minstrel shows centered around the old plantation and centered around people in blackface wearing rags and performing banjo and bones. And so that became the focus of the minstrel show. But after it became established and a big success, they felt free to do other stuff as well. But I think it probably would have been confusing or too much work to all of a sudden take off your blackface for one particular skit and then put it back on for another.
Okay.
That's my guess.
Okay. Okay. Now, did the Sambo character exist prior to the minstrel show in any?
Oh, absolutely. You've got, in the 18th century, you've got blackface performers in circuses, on ships, on various stages, doing all sorts of things. And you've got early plays, 18th century plays with characters named Sambo. So that goes back a ways. The minstrel show didn't actually exist until the 1840s.
Mm-hmm. So, but the Sambo character, even in that earlier tradition, was always a black character that fit certain stereotypes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. What was Frederick Douglass's reaction to the minstrel show?
Frederick Douglass was appalled by minstrelsy in general, and he had a rather specific. He wrote about a very early African American minstrel troupe that, and this was well before the Civil War. They were doing white minstrel shtick, not very successfully, I may add, and touring. And Frederick Douglass said, you know, it's time for a theatrical troupe to portray African Americans as they really are, not as these buffoons. And he was calling for a better representation of his race. At the same time, he was grateful to see African American performers perform at all. But he had pretty strong feelings against minstrelsy.
Okay. The Virginia Minstrels, was that mm-hmm. who were they again?
Now, this was a group of four whites. I believe one was a Southerner, the rest were Northerners. I can't remember exactly, but they originated the minstrel show. They were the first performers to call themselves minstrels. They were the first performers to play instruments during their show. Blackface performers. And so they changed the minstrel show. I mean, they basically originated it. They didn't last very long. I think they only lasted a year or two, but they were kind of the ones that made the minstrel show what it became.
Okay, understood. Now, after emancipation, you start seeing blacks performing in minstrel shows.
Mm-hmm.
There were other kinds of black entertainment, though, right? You listed a few of them: Jubilees, Black Theater. How did those compare to the minstrel show? Like, what made them different?
Well, there were a number of different theatrical troupes. The most prominent is the Hire Sisters, and they performed uplifting drama centered around African Americans. The Fisk Jubilee Singers and other Jubilee groups who performed spirituals in a very cultured, high-class way. There were black opera singers and pianists. So there were a lot of different things that African Americans were doing in terms of performance. But minstrelsy was by far the most successful.
Okay. Now, there was one guy you mentioned, I forgot his name. He actually was a black actor who had to pretend to be white to play blackface. So do you remember that?
Thinking of William Henry Lane. He was his nickname was Master Juba. He was the first African American blackface performer to be a real success. His story is that he was a great dancer in New York, and only a kid, really. I think he was in his teens. And Barnum, who would later become famous as for Barnum and Bailey Circus, well, P.T. Barnum had this show, and his lead dancer, it was a blackface show, his lead dancer, John Diamond, was unable to make it, and so he asked Master Juba if he would fill in, and he painted him in blackface so that people wouldn't be able to tell that he was really black, because if they'd known that there was a black person on stage, they would have asked for their money back or rioted or something. I mean, New York audiences were not ready to see black performers on stage at this point. This was in the 1840s. Well, Master Juba was such an amazing dancer that it didn't take long before he revealed himself for who he really was. He had contests with John Diamond, you know, so there was a black performer versus a white performer. And sometimes he won those contests in front of white judges, in front of white audiences. And he went on to be one of the greatest dancers of his day. He toured the world, and Charles Dickens wrote about him. But he died quite young. I think he was only in his 20s when he died.
Okay. Another question I have for you. Why was it so important for the minstrel promoters to argue that the minstrel show was an authentic representation of black life? You made that point in the book.
It was a selling point. It differentiated them from the white troops. So Americans have always been attracted to things that build, you know, performances that build themselves as authentic in some way or another. And this was just one added reason, one added incentive to go see this minstrel show. It's like, hey, we've got real blacks from the plantation, not just whites dressed as them. You know, this is going to be different. This is going to be better. It's going to be cooler. I mean, African Americans had, even back then, a reputation for being fantastic entertainers. And so, you know, this was just another aspect that could help sell tickets. It didn't mean that they tried especially hard to duplicate any kind of performances that they might have put on while they were slaves. Mm-hmm. It just meant that they billed themselves as true plantation slaves so that they could sell more tickets.
Yeah, keeping it real.
Yeah.
That's what we call it nowadays.
Yep.
Just out of, another thing I was kind of curious about, in your studies, is there any equivalent to minstrelsy in, say, any other ethnic comedy, Jewish comedy, for example?
I think, you know, the thing is that in other ethnic comedy, all ethnicities play on the traits, on stereotypes. But what I think the difference is that African Americans have played precisely the stereotypes that were used against them the most. Mm-hmm. Whereas Jews did not. I mean, Jewish comedy does not really deal with the whole stereotype of the master of the world's finances or, you know, those kinds of representations that have been used to, or, you know, the Jews who kill Christian babies. That's not part of Jewish humor. Mm-hmm. And those are the stereotypes that have been used to target Jews. Whereas African Americans do use those same stereotypes that are used to target them, they use in their comedy. So it's a little edgier, you'd have to say. It's a little bit closer to the edge. I mean, the other thing that comes to mind is in South Africa, you've got the coloreds putting on the Coon Carnival on New Year's Day in Cape Town every year, where they put on whiteface and dress like plantation slaves. Which is, you know, so there's a kind of parallel version of minstrelsy in a totally other culture, but that the Coon Carnival arose because of a visit of a minstrel troupe in the 19th century, a black minstrel troupe in the 19th century to Cape Town, where the Cape Townians were so impressed by how African Americans had been emancipated from slavery that they adopted the traits that they saw in that minstrel show. So that's a curious twist.
Okay. Now, who was Burt Williams and why was he significant?
Burt Williams was one of the greatest African-American comedians. He was huge in the 1900s and 1910s and 1920s. He transformed minstrelsy because he wore blackface, but instead of and spoke in dialect, but instead of being outrageously buffoonish wildly exaggerated, he took a very subtle approach and portrayed the downtrodden African American, the one who's always being put upon, the one who's suffering terrible misfortune, and he used pathos in his comedy so that he would make his audience weep as well as laugh. He was a Pierrot figure and had an incredible impact on American entertainment. He was like, you know, in terms of recording artists, he was one of the three highest paid recording artists of his day. And I'm not just talking about black recording artists. I'm talking about recording artists, period. He was certainly the most popular comedian of his time, black or white. And so he had a tremendous impact on New York culture and American culture in general. But no one really precisely followed in his footsteps. No one really took his art of pathos and transformed it into something else that, you know, so in a way it's, I don't know how much impact he actually had, though he was very famous during his day.
Okay. Now, how did he have a hard time reconciling sort of the stereotype with the more, you know, I guess you could say socially relevant portrait of the downtrodden man?
Well, he was he had an interesting take. He was a West Indian, and he was also very well educated and spoke, spoke extremely well. He considered himself a little bit distinct from the African American, the average African American, whom he studied a great deal in order to do his act. He made no bones about that distinction. I mean, everybody knew that this was Burt Williams and that the performer he played on stage was absolutely nothing like who he really was. And he said that he felt liberated when he put on blackface because then he could become this other, this completely different person. I don't think he felt uncomfortable about doing that. He worked with a guy named William Walker, who hated blackface and never wore it. And they had this duo act called Two Real Coons. So he was exposed to the kind of anti-minstrelsy feeling that was prevalent at the time. But he still insisted on wearing blackface because that was the only way he could really portray his character. I think that he did not like the conventional minstrel act because he didn't do it. He didn't perform the songs that Al Jolson performed. He didn't sing songs like Waiting for the Robert E. Lee. He wrote his own material or had other people write his material for him that departed a little bit from what the conventional minstrel and coon songs of the day were, just to fit that character that he played. And he was a very dignified person and did not consider his act undignified at all. He dignified minstrelsy by evoking pathos and not just laughter.
Mm-hmm. Now, you compared his work to the Al Jolson songs or Waiting for Robert E. Lee. What were those songs about?
Oh, those songs were about happy plantation darkies, you know? Those were really popular. You probably know some of them. I mean, Sweet Georgia Brown mm-hmm. had its origins in precisely that kind of minstrel thing. Louis Armstrong's theme song, When It's Sleepy Time Down South, was another one of these happy darkies on the plantation songs. And he sang it at every single concert he gave. And that was, he sang it well over 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. And that song was written by African-Americans and performed by African-Americans. And that was basically the standard portrayal. And that's not the kind of material that Burt Williams did at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, Louis Armstrong, he never performed in blackface, right? I can't remember if I read that in the book or not.
No, he never performed in blackface except when he was Zulu King. When he marched with the Zulu crew in New Orleans in the 1940s or 30s, I can't remember now, he wore blackface then because all the Zulus wore blackface. Mm-hmm. So, and he was very proud of it, too.
Yeah. Describe the evolution of the Zulu crew. I know they went from embodying some pretty racist stereotypes to changing over the years, right?
Well, they haven't changed that much. I mean, they started out, they got their inspiration from a skit about cannibals that they saw in 1909, I believe. Yeah. And so they, the Zulu crew in New Orleans, they paint their faces black with white circles around their mouths and eyes, and they wear Afro wigs and occasionally they'll have a bone through their nose. They wear grass skirts. And so they basically embody the caricature of the cannibal that has existed since probably the 18th century.
Even to this day?
And even to this day, yeah. And they still perform, they still dress that way. You can see them on Mardi Gras Day parading. There's a big parade on Mardi Gras Day down in New Orleans. And some of them have changed the costume a little bit to represent more fierce African tribes. You know, they'll put on more kind of war paint instead of blackface, mm-hmm. Or wear more elaborate African kind of costumes. But the majority of them are pretty simple, basic Zulu. The same kind of Zulu caricature that's always been that way. But the meaning has changed. I mean, people never associate Zulu with cannibals or with minstrelsy anymore down there. They just associate it with tradition. I mean, the Zulu crew has been around for over 100 years and people just associate it with that. Now, there were some major changes in the 60s. The Urban League and the NAACP got on their case. This was in the days of the militant black power, and wearing blackface was just not acceptable. And the Zulu crew almost vanished in the 1960s. They went for several years without wearing blackface. And they had to be protected from other African Americans by the police. And there was a split in the crew. It was a really hard time, but, by the 70s, they managed to get themselves back up and became this totally establishment institution. And they're very much an accepted part of the New Year's Day festivities, unlike the Mardi Gras Indians, who have always kept themselves on the edge and have always had this very rebellious character.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned earlier a coon song. What is a coon song?
Well, the coon songs were the hottest thing in popular music from about 1890 to 1910. And this was, coon songs were written by blacks and by whites, performed by blacks and by whites, sold via sheet music. And they were funny songs, always comic, about a character, an urban African-American character called a coon, who was something of an outlaw, you know, played dice a lot, but also, you know, used a razor, was a libertine, and was kind of sexed up, and it was all about his adventures. Sometimes he got into, he had, you know, he had fun adventures. Sometimes he got into scrapes. But it was a kind of idea, a kind of liberating genre, because these coon characters could be as wild and crazy as they wanted to be in these songs. And at the same time, they embodied stereotypes, racist stereotypes that were vicious in nature. So, you know, it was, again, like most of American culture, it was a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. And now, so the coon and the way you describe it and the zip coon are the same. Is that the same character, essentially?
The coon in the coon song is a development. I mean, you don't have, the zip coon starts out as a plantation character who is country through and through, whereas the coon in the coon song is much more urban, mm-hmm. and it reflects the migration of African Americans from country to the cities. Mm-hmm. Also, the coon song was, coon songs mostly were written in New York City, you know, so they didn't. Well, I guess a lot of minstrelsy came from New York City. in general, it was less of a country thing. It was more of an urban thing.
Got you. Well, obviously, that's what a lot of people compare gangster rappers to. And mm-hmm. we'll come to that in a minute. But two songs I want to talk to you about, coon songs. One, All Coons Look Alike to Me. What was the theme of that? That was the most popular one, right?
Yeah, that was by Ernest Hogan. When he wrote it, I mean, Ernest Hogan was a huge minstrel star and then became a huge coon song star. And I believe he was the one who was billed as the unbleached American. he wrote it, All Coons Alike to Me, in the song is the refrain of a woman who says to him, all coons look alike to me. Mm-hmm. And so he's not saying all coons look alike. Mm-hmm. He's saying, this is what this woman said to me, which is kind of not a good thing to say. So if you just take the title, it sounds like a much worse song than it is. But it was a huge hit. There are a number of versions of it, but some of them are, and most of them performed by whites in kind of a faux black dialect. But there's an energy to this song and a fun to it that's really hard to get away from. I mean, almost all the recorded performances of it have this incredible energy to it, to them. It's an amazing song.
Mm-hmm. What about Every Nation Has a Flag Except the Coon?
I don't know that one.
Okay.
I
read an article by Mencken, H.L. Mencken.
Yeah.
One of the points he made, and he mentioned that song in particular, but he also made the point that the coon song actually helped popularize the term coon. Did you find that in your research also?
Well, I know that the term coon as applied to African Americans was not as vicious a term as it is today. Mm-hmm. And I've read that it wasn't until like around 1905 that it became a really vicious term. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know exactly how true that is, but yeah.
Okay. Lincoln Perry, why is he significant?
Well, Step and Fetch It was a huge, huge star of the screen. he's significant because he embodied the stereotype of the ultra lazy, ultra slow worker who never lifted a finger unless he absolutely had to and did anything he could to get out of doing a day's worth of work. But he was a sly figure, too, in many of the films where he would mutter something underneath his breath that would give away that he was his own man. And he got away with a lot of stuff. So he was extremely popular. But Step and Fetch It now has a reputation. You know, if you call someone a Step and Fetch It, it's a really bad thing to call someone, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I think the reason for that is that in part due to his popularity and because he was such a buffoon and in part because he was so incredibly unthreatening, he was the biggest African-American star in Hollywood for decades. And any other African-Americans who tried to make it in Hollywood were always told to portray the same kind of person as Step and Fetch It. Mm-hmm. Just really hard, you know. It's tough on a whole race when you're characterized in that way.
Yeah. Now, was he was never in blackface, though, right?
No, he did not wear blackface.
So by this point, we're away from actual blackface, but the minstrel tradition still sort of carries on in some of these characters.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Amos and Andy, what was the significance of that show?
Well, it starts out as a radio show, that's done by two whites who are blackface performers. They're from the blackface tradition, and it is a kind of soap opera serial comedy show where the characters get into trouble, but the plot really develops from week to week. I mean, from show to show, day to day. It was by far the most popular radio show in America's history. And then they decide to make it into a TV show, and they want to get real African-American actors. So they get Spencer Williams, Tim Moore, and I'm blanking on who played Andy. But they get this really talented group of actors, and these actors ban Gosden and Correll, the white actors, they ban them from the set so that they're trying to create a real African-American show. What happens with the TV show is that it becomes dominated by Kingfish, played by Tim Moore, who is totally, just a really hammy actor and plays up the character to the hilt. Very funny, but people really don't want to see that. It situates African Americans as, you know, this is the only African American presence on TV, and it's dominated by this kind of buffoonish guy who's always rolling his eyes and is always scheming for money and never actually getting any. And, you know, it's pretty, pretty problematic for this to be the only representation of African-Americans on TV. And so the NAACP succeed in getting it off the air. Although then it's syndicated and it's on the air some more. And it also becomes a symbol of bad representations of African-Americans on TV. You know, anything after Amos and Andy, any representation of African Americans on TV that is considered bad becomes tarred with the Amos and Andy brush.
Right, right. That's how I would have heard it described.
Yeah.
How did Steppin' and Fetch It, Amos and Andy, just the minstrel tradition in as a whole affect comedians like Bill Cosby?
Well, Bill Cosby was reacting against that tradition, and he makes that pretty clear. He is trying to present dignified African Americans, trying to make comedy that's not about the stereotypes especially these particular stereotypes, he takes every opportunity he can get to speak against the minstrel tradition. And, you know, and he carries on in that way. He speaks out against hip hop because he sees it as part of that tradition too. Mm-hmm. So I think the minstrel tradition really did affect and influence Bill Cosby in a lot of ways. But it's all a reaction against it, that kind of influence.
And so as we move through the 60s, 70s, we come to another show, sort of someone channeling the minstrel tradition, Good Times with Jimmy Walker. First question, I was shocked when I read in the book that Jimmy Walker was at one point the official comedian of the Black Panther Party. How did that come about? Any idea?
That you're going to have to ask Jake.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
It just was one of those things. It just jumped out at me. I couldn't believe it. What was the significance of Jimmy Walker, Good Times, that whole dynamic?
Well, I think there you had one. I think you've got an example there of how one performer can really change a TV show. I mean, Good Times was one of those Norman Lear spinoffs from All in the Family. And the Jeffersons and, you know, all the other ones, all those other Norman Lear shows. It takes on a very different dynamic because of Jimmy Walker's, you know, very minstrel-like performance. Mm-hmm. The other actors on the show were horrified that the show was moving in this direction and couldn't really do anything about it because he was just so popular. Whites like to see that stuff.
So hip hop sort of comes to the fore in the early 80s, and we start seeing sort of new, maybe versions of minstrelsy, but they're different. How do you distinguish between, say, the Zip Coon and the gangster rapper?
Part of it is intent. The gangster rap is a threatening music, and it's funny in some ways, but it's not meant to be that funny. It's really it's a very different kind of intention, whereas the Coon song was essentially a comic song. So there's a difference in intent. There's a difference in degree. The violence in Coon songs was not that bad. The violence in gangster rap is just out of this world. So gangster rap's a very, I think it has few parallels, precise parallels in American culture. Mm-hmm. It is a very distinctive form. So it has been labeled minstrelsy by a lot of cultural commentators and compared to Amos and Andy and what have you. But Jake and I think it's of a different degree. Just at the very most basic level, it's the intent of the performers, whether it's to just provoke laughs or do something quite different. Mm-hmm.
And so in the Coon song, the Coon with the straight razor, wasn't meant to intimidate?
I don't think so, no. That was a really all in fun. It was just part of the comedy. In almost all minstrel-like material, there's the setup, let's put it this way, that any performance there's an imaginary performance space around the performer, and the performance space in minstrelsy, as in the Coon song, and in rap music as well, is a space of blacks only, where there are no whites. On the minstrel stage, there was never a white character. The slave owners weren't there. The policemen were not there in the Coon song. Mm-hmm. So this space, this performance space, was a space that was liberating for the performers and for the audiences. because these were oppressed people who could feel in the while during watching these performers or singing these songs, they could feel like they were free from oppression. Mm-hmm. The minstrels get to eat as much as they want. They get to work as little as they want. They're having a great time. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true with the coons and the coon song. And, to a degree, the same thing is true with many of the gangster rappers. Mm-hmm. So there is that. That's where the similarities are.
Mm-hmm. And so a character like Flavor Flav, he was someone you guys wrote about a lot.
Yeah.
Describe the minstrel controversy as it involves Flavor Flav.
Well, Flavor Flav is, you know, his very minstrelish, buffoonish act seemed to have a political bent when he was with Public Enemy. Mm-hmm. He was parodying minstrelsy in a way, and it looked like he was making fun of minstrelsy, and he was making fun of the whole buffoonish tradition. Mm-hmm. And it was very effective the way he paired with Chuck D. He provided some comic relief from Chuck D's anger, but at the same time he was angry too in some ways, and you know, it really worked. When he went out on his own, the edge was gone, you know, without Chuck D to be with and to contrast with. He was just a buffoon in the same way that the great minstrel performers of the 19th century were. And there was nothing dignified about what he did anymore. He basically embodied all the negative stereotypes that whites have about African Americans and have had for centuries without lending any kind of irony or signifying to it.
Mm-hmm. What define signifying just for us?
Well, it's playing off stereotypes in a kind of sly and clever way. There's a lot of ways to do that. And signifying has a long tradition, but I don't know.
I think I get what you mean. It's sort of like you sort of poke fun at the stereotype itself.
That's right. Yeah. You can turn it on its head. Yeah.
Got you. That makes sense. That makes sense. Spike Lee bamboozled. He tackled the portrayal of blacks in the media, and he was very specific in labeling a lot of characters, minstrels, and that kind of thing. What does he get sort of historically right? What does he get wrong in your view?
He tends to lump black minstrels and white minstrels together, which I think is not totally right. You know, in that montage sequence in Bamboozled, he puts black minstrels in with white representations of coons and pickaninnies, which muddies the water somewhat. And the performers and the performers Sleep and Eat in the Manton show that he puts on in Bamboozled, they don't get all the minstrel routines quite right. They make a few mistakes. And I don't think Spike Lee sees anything good that has ever come out of the minstrel tradition. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that it's a dignified tradition in any way or that it deserves to be applauded, but there are, you know, certain aspects of it that are very rich and that have proven intensely satisfying. to a great number of audiences and performers. And instead of really signifying on that tradition, Spike Lee's attacking it. And Bamboozled is an extremely angry film. I think it may be his angriest film ever. Mm-hmm. As a result, it works. I mean, it's an incredible work of art. I don't think it attempts to deal with minstrelsy in a fair and balanced way. It's a real attack on the tradition. Mm-hmm.
And so how did minstrelsy further art, music, acting in America?
Well, it gave African Americans tremendous opportunities to be entertainers. You know, without the minstrel show, I don't think African American entertainers would have had as many opportunities to perform. So it gave us a lot of great performers, a lot of great art, a lot of great songs came out of the tradition. A lot of careers were made. So, and I think just providing African American audiences and performers with this liberating space, I think helped them keep their sanity in the midst of terrible oppression.
What's the danger of, say, because one point you made in the book was about how the new understanding of minstrelsy sort of conflates everything that portrays blacks in a negative way as minstrelsy, basically. What's the danger with that kind of characterization?
Well, basically what you're doing is you're weaponizing the word minstrelsy. And when you do that, it changes history. If you're saying that gangster rappers are minstrels, that changes what minstrels were. Mm-hmm. And that's a dangerous thing to mess with history like that. I don't think we want to do that. For example, the word minstrel has become so negative and such a weapon that there was this exhibit devoted to 100 years of the Zulu crew in New Orleans at the Presbyterian in 2009, and the word minstrel was never used in that entire exhibit, even though the Zulu crew started as basically a minstrel-inspired routine. So because using that word is just it's a bad word. What happens when you just call anything, you know, any negative stereotype of African Americans, if you call it minstrelsy, it just means that minstrelsy becomes almost ahistorical. It becomes this denial of everything. Mm-hmm. So
okay, so this might be a kind of a strange question, but with hip hop, for example, we have subgenres. We have conscious rap. We have gangster rap, that kind of thing. Were there black, like, conscious minstrels? You know what I mean? Like, when it was still blackface and that kind of thing.
You mean, did minstrelsy ever take on a
dignified sort of presentation of black life, or not non-stereotypical presentation of black? I mean, I know we talked about Bert. I forgot Bert Williams.
Williams,
and his sort of using pathos and really elevating like the art form itself. But did any of it portray blacks as middle class, or you know, in the same way that the more I'm trying to think of an example. But you understand the question, though?
Yeah. Well, I don't. You're not going to get the Huxtables on a minstrel show. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so. But on the other hand, there was a recognition in some of the material around slavery, both in the White Minstrel Show and in the Black Minstrel Show, you get slaves who are being torn from their families and subjected to cruelty, and there's a or running away. There's a recognition that slavery is cruel, and this is in the, you know, before emancipation, the pre-emancipation White Minstrel Show has songs and routines about the cruelty of slavery. So there is that, but I don't really think that minstrelsy is the ideal performance site for socially conscious material. And so I think that there's quite a gulf there. Also, minstrelsy has always been about low comedy, not sophisticated comedy. That's just one of its characteristics from its birth.
Got it. That makes sense. I think that's it. We covered a lot of material, I think. I enjoyed the book. I thought it was, I'm somebody who, I love Bamboozled. I have a lot of problems with gangster rap. And so it never, you know, I read Stanley Crouch's take on hip hop. He's probably harsher than I am, but, but I still sympathize with a lot of it. But I think your book definitely takes the minstrel tradition and sort of puts it in historical perspective, which, you know, I think is important.
Thanks.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks.
Guys, you've been listening to New Books Network African American Studies, and our guest has been Yuval Taylor. Thanks a lot for listening, and take care.